With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
Just to look through the front pages before I'm joined by my newspaper panel in the studio. The Irish Times this morning leading with drug raids linked to highly impure cocaine. Seizures of just 2% purity with drug composed almost entirely of other substance is the headline. And then below the fold, as they say, Christy Moore was questioned under UK terror laws for curiosity value. This is one of several stories that is in the state papers, the declassified state papers that are across the papers this morning. The Irish Daily Mail also leading with a drug-related story. Teenagers now buying heroin and cocaine on social media, writes Gareth McNamee. Online drug menu enables teens to buy deadly narcotics through the post for as little as €40. The Irish Independent this Saturday morning, and you may need to be reminded it's Saturday if you're in the middle of that Christmas morass, state to buy buildings and develop them into centres for childcare, writes Tabitha Monaghan. The government plans to move ahead with purchasing buildings across the country to develop state-led childcare facilities, with proposals due in the new year. The Herald goes with the dying breed. More than 70 XL bully dogs destroyed since the ban was introduced in February, and Dubliners had the most exemptions but also the highest number of pets put down. And finally, to the Irish Examiner, climate events cost the poor most. This is some of the climate things, the wildfires, flooding, etc. We've seen, unfortunately, a bit too often over the last few years, they cost the poorer parts of the world most. And then their off-lead story, Billy Kelleher, I would have won the race for the Auris had he been the candidate. We will talk about that in some detail a little bit later on with my newspaper panel, who are joining me now. Barry Kenny, Head of Corporate Communications at Éireann Róid Éireann, Valerie Cox, author and journalist, Fergus Finlay, columnist with the Irish Examiner and former CEO of Bernardo's, and Louisa Meehan of Woodview HRM. Good morning all, and thank you for coming in this
morning, Sean.
Good morning.
Christmas.
Yes.
A lovely Christmas had, Barry?
Yeah, I have to say all eyes were on the 26th for me. Just, it was quite a hectic build up. I was doing the cooking this year
for a
larger group, so the 26th was everything I hoped it would be in terms of sleeping on, doing not a whole lot, clearing things off. I'd recorded on the telly. Fabulous.
The 26th, I think, is actually the better day, Fergus.
Well, I love Christmas Day. I adore Christmas Day. Although I have been told that I do a very good impression of a grumpy old man for most of Christmas Day. But I love it, and I've always loved it. I've always loved Christmas. We spent Christmas in Shillelagh with our grandkids, Vicky and her kids and Tony, and I've just come up from there. Shillelagh is a lovely little town, although the people of Shillelagh themselves refer to it as the arse end of Wicklow. It's one of those little towns that you only go to if you're going there, you know,
right,
not on the road to anywhere. So it's beautifully isolated and quiet and calm. At night, you can see nothing but stars. There's no, you know, light pollution of any kind. And I just thought the whole thing was fab, absolutely fab.
And when you say your grumpy old man impression, what is that? Is that like you're falling asleep by 2 o'clock with the Baileys tipping out of your hand or what?
No, I unlike this article that I've been reading in the Irish Times about predictions, I never touch Baileys before four, never. I think you get to a certain age and you feel entitled to give out a lot and groan a lot and whinge. And every time you get up out of a chair, it involves a kind of an involuntary groan, you know. Barry, you're getting to that age. And you'll get there eventually. So,
Valerie, a Wicklow Christmas.
Yeah, the other part of the arse end of Wicklow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is lovely. And, you know, Christmas Day, Stephen's Day, you get lots of people walking on the beach, enjoying the forests. I think it's a very special place. And, you know, as Fergus said, all the little villages and everything make such an effort. It really is an old-fashioned Christmas, if you like. In my own family, the food is complicated. We've got vegetarian, we've got fish, and we've got meat. So, you know, lots of things to cook and so on. Everybody digs in and gives a hand. But, you know, this Betwixtmas thing, you know, she has us lying, it's Laura Kennedy, and she has us lying around watching Cleopatra, filling the stillness with dumb TV, after dinner sandwiches for days on end until the ham turns yellow or something, and at the aforesaid Bailey's at 3 o'clock. But you know something? It's not like that for everybody. And I think an awful lot of people listening to us today are thinking, that wasn't my Christmas. And I'm thinking particularly of people who are carers. The days don't change if you're a carer. You are looking after somebody with great love and all of that. But, you know, the days don't change that much. You are not lolling around. You're looking after somebody. And I think we need to acknowledge that with people who have spent we've thousands and thousands of carers. Some of them are very young. Some of them are very old. But they're all looking after a loved one. Mm. And, you know, many places at Christmas where they might have respite care even closed down, and they're looking after family members they mightn't normally have at home. And I think we should just remember people like that because, you know, it's not all lazing around with the Baileys. There is another side of Christmas, and it's a happy side as well, and it's a wonderful side, and you're so pleased to have people at home. But, you know, we should just remember it.
Yeah, it's not an easy time for
everybody. Ballard and I, before we went on, we were talking about two people with Down syndrome that we know, that we would have in common, that we know and that we're friends with each other. And it's a little known fact that people with Down syndrome have a 1 in 3 chance of attracting dementia in their 50s. And a 50% chance of getting dementia in their 60s. So a lot of our kids that we would have, I have a daughter with Down syndrome, they're getting to that age where dementia is an issue in their lives. Mandy has lost a lot of friends already. Fortunately, I think I'm probably closer to dementia than she is. But when you're surrounded by disability, particularly, you never get a chance to get the foot off the pedal.
Mm.
And I, like Valerie, we all know people who have those issues in their lives, and there's no respite. No respite at all.
And
even in the richest country in the world.
Well, while we've taken that little detour, there is actually a very interesting article in the Mail today about Alzheimer's, and that actually we're a lot closer to perhaps a cure than a lot of people would think, because it does affect a huge amount of people across the country.
It does. I think most of us at this stage have lost very close friends or family with Alzheimer's. I have spent a long time visiting old people's homes. I mean, you wouldn't want to get me started on this. I think one of the worst features of Ireland, and I'll give you an argument about this if you want one, but I'm sure you don't, is the way we outsource Alzheimer's and we outsource dementia and we outsource old age. We pay enormous amounts of money to very large, profitable institutions to care for our elderly people and our people with dementia. And you cannot walk into there was a time in Ireland where nursing homes and old folks' homes were for old folk. They are now packed to the gunnels with people with dementia. And you can't walk in without coming away feeling, oh my God, the neglect, the horror, the awfulness. Even in the best-run places, the loneliness and the isolation of some of that old age is scandalous.
Yeah, it is. And look, it's a fair end. There will be people up and down the country, I'm sure, who will have had people who are in nursing homes more full-time. We have it in our family, and they might have come out for a day or two over Christmas, and it's a difficult thing to see this time of year, Louisa, but I suppose, look, we're looking at some of the other stories that are through the papers today, and you might bring us into this story on the front page of the Irish Independent. This is a story about childcare, while we're talking about care for people, because, again, I feel like we've heard this headline before in relation to not only childcare, but in relation to IPAS centres, in relation to accommodation. What are they writing about on the front page?
So what they're talking about here in relation to childcare is having state-owned facilities averaging at around 100 places for children between the ages of 1 and 3. And what we're looking at is the government sort of building those facilities, a very strong commitment to limiting the cost of childcare to €200 per child per month. But they're looking, they're saying that today there's 40,000 children currently on a wait list. And going back to the conversation around caring, you know, I think when we look at childcare, when we look at caring responsibilities, we should be really careful, because the majority of those responsibilities rest on the shoulders of women, and access for women into their careers, etc. And not exclusively, and there's lots of men who are very actively involved in it as well. But we do need to have the correct level of supports. As I was reading this article, one of the things that really stood out to me, and it's not covered in the article, is that whilst we, of course, need to put childcare facilities in place for all children, we do need to first deal with the children who are most vulnerable in society. And there's a lot of children out there who live in state-provided accommodation. And for those children, and I know of one in particular who's very close to our family, they've had to relocate halfway across the country because there is no facility in the area that it should be in. I live in Wicklow, for them to go to. And so they've been uprooted from their entire support system because there isn't proper childcare. And I'm not talking about childcare for 3-4 hours a day. I'm talking about a child who needs to be in care 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, including Christmas Day. And so, you know, I think that this is, it's a really, really important, but I do worry a little bit. Are we looking at the areas that are good for politicians to get votes rather than the areas that are necessary for the people who are vulnerable in society?
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned sort of those two sides of it, because we often talk about it in the short hours of the day and there's a huge crisis there. But when you look at the wider care system, and I think this may be the point of this, the infrastructure for care in general is totally creaking at the seams.
Because care cannot be provided exclusively by the state. So the truth of the matter is that children will receive the best care when that care is provided by a caregiver within their family unit. But when you have a society that requires two people to work in order to be able to have a normal home and normal functioning family, then it is impossible to have a situation where people can both, or one person can be at home, irrespective of the gender of that person. So we're trying to have a society that resembles the 1950s with happy children who have all of this support, but have a situation whereby mums and dads both need to work 40 hours a week. We're looking at situations with less hybrid working. So we're adding back in 2-hour commutes each way, lots of people commuting 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the evening, leaving home before their children get up, getting home after they go to bed. So irrespective of putting in place childcare facilities, we need to look at the infrastructure, and we need to really take a longer term view in terms of how do we want to better support families from birth through to death, not how do we support people between the ages of 1 and 3. I mean, not that those people aren't precious. They're gorgeous. Love them. All for them. But it's window dressing.
Right.
When you talk about the long commute and the difficulty being part of that family, we need to go back to the basics, though, and the options, and say, you know, why are we not thinking around this? We need a little bit of original thinking. And why are these people working? Now, OK, people have careers, they want to work, absolutely fine. But there are some people who don't want that commute, who don't want that pressure. And why are we not just supporting these families so that maybe mum or dad could stay at home while the kids are small and look after them and put money into that instead of buying all these anonymous buildings to farm out our 1 to 3 year olds? Of course we need childcare, but I think there's another way of looking at it, of supporting the individual family and say, okay, you don't have to drive from Mullingar to Dublin in the morning. You stay home, you mind your kids, and we will make sure your mortgage is paid. That is what a care government would do.
And that's what they do in other parts of the world. I mean, I hate the term childcare. I think it was Charlie McCreevy who invented the word, actually. There was a time in Ireland, and some of us will remember it, when childcare was mother's responsibility. Mums weren't allowed to work. Work was the man's prerogative, career was the man's prerogative, and childcare was the woman's responsibility. Full stop, end of story. Then we decided that we had to force women out to work because the economy needed it. We changed the tax system to enable that. And then we discovered that we had this big problem. There was nobody looking after the children. So we did what we always do in Ireland. We found a way of giving grants. The last time I looked at it, there were 4,000 private providers in Ireland being paid by the state to run childcare facilities. Now, many of them are wonderful and great and good people and so on. But we're the only country in the world that never uses the term preschool education, that never recognises the value of early years education. Most civilised countries, I suppose I'm talking about the social democratic world primarily, will support mothers and fathers for the first year of a child's life because they believe the child should be in the mother's arms and the father's arms for the first year of their life. And then they will go into very good quality early years education and proceed from there to education. That's what I've been arguing for years. I don't think we should be building big buildings in fields somewhere. I think every school that has the capacity should have a facility added to it so that preschool education can take place in the school. So the school becomes a campus for preschool, junior school and big school.
Yeah. That's kind of a thread through. It makes an awful lot of sense. Barry, what do you think of it? Because we've seen kind of this before where the state goes looking and says, oh, we'll look at, you know, buildings that Éireann Éireann might have or that Bus Éireann or whoever has, and we're going to make them into XYZ, and it's never worked before.
Well, I mean, you're right in terms of, because it's been identified with housing, the Lands Development Agency and others. And look, in theory, if the current system requires a facility, obviously it is a good thing. My kind of macro worry in all of this is just the latency. It's just how long everything, you know, this is not the first time this has been put forward as an idea. And this is the breeding ground for kind of extremist populism, because if the democratic model can't solve these problems quickly, of course people are going to start looking at alternatives and people that can say, I can do this by diktat and all of this. And it just feeds into that again. It's something that just kind of, this drumbeat on the back of my head all the time is, we need to get these solutions in far more quickly. We need to use a lever. And if this is one of the ways of doing it, great, but do it.
Mm. Would you be sceptical it can be done?
It should be easy to be done. I mean, there certainly seems to be a surfeit of commercial buildings around that one would think would not.
There's a great big depot in, a great big bus depot in Donnybrook, for example. Yeah. You surely don't need a depot there.
Yeah, well, how many times have we talked about that, or Bagot Street Hospital, or all these? Should the LDA took nearly a year and a half just to come up with a list, let alone actually places it could use, Louisa?
Well, one thing that's interesting, if you read the story, and I'd like more information, is that they're talking about this offering from the state being open to current and new providers. So it's not 100% clear how many new places there will be versus how many state-funded places there will be. There's a very big difference between those two things.
Mm. But there's 40,000 children currently on a waiting list to get into a creche. So, I mean, huge numbers of kids. But, I mean, I would like Norma Foley to go back and have a closer look at this and come up with other options.
Yeah.
But I mean, the places thing is a fair point, because there are people who are putting their children down from 9 weeks pregnant and are told they're on a waiting list, genuinely, in my
and
area.
And for secondary
Wicklow.
Schools, they're doing that as well.
And primary schools are nearly as bad. Like, it is genuinely, it frustrates the life out of me, because of all the things that we can predict, you can predict pretty much there'll be about 60,000 babies born every year. And you will also, if you have a year, so let's say take 4 years ago, you can look and say there were X amount of children built. So there, when they turn 4 or 5, there's going to need to be X amount of primary school places. And we just can't see to manage it.
I've done both. So I have two children, 15 and 12. My eldest went into a creche at 1 until sort of 3 and a bit. And when I had my second, I didn't go back to work after maternity leave. And I was at home with him. I mean, he didn't really know I worked until he was well halfway through national school. And I'd been working the whole way through. But I think one of the things that allowed me to do that was my education and my experience. So by the time I took that step out, I was already highly educated and I had a lot of very strong experience. So I then decided to create work for myself and build my own business. But I had the foundations to do that. And so if we enable caregivers, because I was a caregiver, to have the foundations to create the right life for them, and it may not be the same path I took, But if we give them the education, the skills, the qualifications, the experience, etc., so that if they do step out for that period of time, that they can easily transition back in. And actually, what I do now is so much better than what I did before. I'm delighted I'd stepped out, because I would never have got to where I am today had I not done that. But I wouldn't have been able to do that without the strong foundations that were put in place in the first place. And that was down to, I suppose, you know, my parents and what they instilled in me, and opportunity. And I had opportunities that some people don't get. Mm. And we all get opportunities that are unique to us. But that is really fundamentally important. You should be able to step away, be the caregiver, and step back, not step back at a lower level.
To take your break and then have to go in at a lower level and work that way up.
Yeah, that's
but
not fair.
I suppose also, because I think a lot of people, and people can let us know, 087-1400-106 is the WhatsApp. I think a lot of women would like to take that break when the kids are younger, but financially, because of, you know, whether the partner doesn't earn enough, whether they're on their own, whatever, they just can't do it.
They can't. There is, and this is going to sound really judgmental, so I apologise before I say it. There is a small piece, though, of, you know, certainly my mum, my grandparents would have always said, cut your cloth. Like, for that period of time where I wasn't working full time, I was working a little bit, but I wasn't working full time. Like, I never went out to a coffee shop. I didn't get my hair done. I didn't buy new clothes. I didn't do any nice things, really. Nice things were going to the beach and throwing stones in the water and going out for picnics and going for walks where it was free. And I loved it. It was amazing.
Yes, but you're right, Louise. That was pretty judgmental.
It was. But I mean it in the sense that, you know, you can't have everything all at the same time.
None of us can.
You can't have the perfect house and the perfect holidays and the perfect job and the perfect children and the perfect, you can't have it all. So you have to pick what's right for this season and do it to the best of your ability.
Good advice for life, I would say there, perhaps, and certainly heading into the new year as people are formatting their New Year's resolutions. My panel is staying with me. Coming up after the break, Billy Kelleher says he would have won the presidency had he been the candidate. We'll be asking whether he's right. I am still joined by my panel in the studio, Barry Kenny, Valerie Cox, Fergus Finlay and Louisa Meehan are still here. And we're going to be looking at the political awards of the year, because Miriam Lord has been doling them out. And as Fergus commented off air there, no politician wants to be named more than in Miriam's end of year awards. But we're going to start with the Irish Examiner story today. Fergus, we might get your opinion on it. Billy Kelleher thinks he would have won the presidency. Is he right?
Yes, I think I would have won the presidency if I ran. I think Valerie would have had a great shot if she'd run. This is over. The presidential election is over. We have a winner. Won fair and square. It's over. Forget it. Move on. I cannot get over the fact that this was a presidential election that just keeps on giving and giving and giving. Largely thanks to Micheál Martin and Jim Gavin, but the rest of us seem to have an axe to grind about every single aspect of it. It's over now. And, you know, I think all we can do is hope and wish that President Connolly brings the same distinction to the office as her predecessor. Mm.
Barry, it does seem to be the Fianna Fáil can't get out of its own way when it comes to just commenting on this and dragging it into a new year.
Well, I knew the feeling of perhaps, even compared to kind of the previous couple of iterations where you had quite broad fields, you know, where you had quite kind of intensive engagement. It felt like an unsatisfactory election, and that's because of errors by bigger parties. I think, as Fergus says, you know, you have a fair and square winner, and you want the new president, President Connolly, to do well. Would Billy? I mean, I don't. I think the mood is such that it would be very, very hard for a finish, even for any of the two, I suppose, bigger parties that have been in government for such a long time to win. I do think that Billy would have enhance the debate. I think he has in his record in terms of from the very outset, for example, of the Ukraine war, the Russian full-scale invasion, he's been out there, he's been engaged. I think given one of the key topics that President Connolly ran on about defence and militarism and the triple lock, I think
That would have been an interesting debate.
Billy would have given a more convincing, I think, counter-argument to that than Heather Humphreys would have done. But I do think it would be very, very hard, actually, in hindsight, for any politician. I mean, gosh, I was listening to Fergus earlier talking about caring for people with dementia, and I said, you know, that's something that I would have actually loved to hear from Fergus during a campaign like that as well.
Mm. Yeah.
I suppose, Valerie, you could argue that anybody at that stage of the debate, having not an empty chair from the Fianna Fáil candidate, would have brought something else and another dimension, because it did feel towards the end that there was a total lack of new views.
Absolutely. And I think part of the problem towards the end was once Jim Gavin was gone and nobody knew who he was anyway when he came in, that except Micheál Martin maybe. But, you know,
and the GAA fans, in fairness.
Well, true, yes. But the GAA fans, and I don't know the first thing about GAA. I had never heard of Jim Gavin until he was announced. But, you know, I think part of the problem was we didn't have well-known names. We didn't have people with track records. And as you said, if Fergus had gone forward on his track record, he probably would have been elected, because you're talking Jim Gavin, who's he? Fergus Finlay. He's been writing these columns like for decades. We know who the man is. And the same was true of other people around the country.
Tell them in the Examiner, for God's sake. I think I'm brand new.
But, you know, there are other people around the country who would have been recognisable, who had good track records and so on. But I thought the funniest one of Miriam Lord's awards here, it went to the Gushers. And she says, one of the most mortifying aspects of the Jim Gavin debacle was the way Fianna Fáil's senior ministers rushed out to support his inspired choice. And she said, Minister for Children, Norma Foley, again, Norma Foley, she's getting great coverage this morning, a Kerry woman. She outdid them all with her effusive welcome for the former Dublin GAA manager. She said, we would be blessed beyond measure to have him as a Fianna Fáil candidate and ultimately as president, she gurgled, of the former Air Corps pilot. Service is the hallmark of a good president. We need a president of the time and of the now. And as Miriam says, that wasn't Jim.
Gurgled is a fantastic word. Louisa, did any of the particular awards jump out to you? This is Miriam Lord's year, the 2025 yes. political awards in the Irish Times today.
So the one that really stood out to me when I was reflecting on the year was the cringe event of the year, which is what she refers to it, and what she's talking about there was the Trump and Zelensky interview, which I think, yes, it was cringeworthy, but it was also very, very dangerous, potentially, because he was so offensive on a public stage to another world leader. Whether he likes him or not is irrelevant. Whether we like Zelensky or not, it doesn't actually matter who likes who in the situation. But you don't invite somebody into your home, which is what he did, and publicly insult them. And I think that that was a very, it was absolutely cringeworthy. It was extremely difficult to watch. And for me, it was the standout moment that she touches on, because it was exactly what she's calling it. But actually, we're lucky that that's all it is.
I'm terrified, by the way, that we're going to repeat potentially tomorrow, because unfortunately, President Zelensky has to go over and debase himself again.
In Mar-a-Lago this time.
Yeah, as unfortunately every world leader has to do when going over the States at the moment, and, you know, grovel for crumbs of respectability of a deal. I've done a couple of stints of volunteering in Ukraine. I was back from Ukraine 2 days before that meeting in the White House in February or early March, whichever it was. And like in the run up to it, while I was there, he was calling Zelensky a dictator, and just, I can't tell you the fear and the stress and the mental health crisis that's going on in that country. It's terrifying. It really is. And you know, speaking of the resilience of people and speaking of kind of everything they are doing effectively to protect our way of life in Europe, quite frankly, and then to suddenly see your supposed ally and benefactor switch sides, it has been utterly destructive to mental health, and that's the very long term crisis that Ukraine is facing.
Yeah, I don't know. You're still in contact with some of the people you met over there, but what's the mood like now that it looks as though Trump just wants a deal before the end of the year, whether that's a heavily Russian favored deal or not?
Yeah, it's. I mean, I don't think anybody believed the kind of that initial 28 point or whatever it was, the Putin Witkoff deal, as you would describe it. I don't think anybody, you know, that's a recipe for a civil war, quite frankly. If, you know what I mean? That was total capitulation. I think the idea that some sort of referendum come in, people are very, very weary. Nobody wants to give up something that you've defended and defended at enormous cost for so long. So it's very, very complex. But I say the one thing I will say, and I see it in people that they're that I know and hear it from them, is just how broken so many people are at this stage. You know, nothing, despite what some people on the extreme left and extreme right say, nothing justifies a single Russian boot having set foot in that country.
Yeah, it's remarkable. It'll be a remarkable few days to watch as well as that goes on. Just to return, I suppose, to those political... And Fergus, you want to come in there?
I just wanted to ask Betty, because one of the things that really strikes me, and this is probably a really stupid thing, Barry, but how incompetent the Russians are in their assault on Ukraine. I mean, a child's death is a terrible thing. Three deaths is an awful thing. But they send 500 drones in one night. They send 150 missiles, and they kill three people. And the country's back up and running the following day because of the resilience of the emergency services. The Russians, there must be some sense in Ukraine that we are seeing them off, or they're not beating us.
Yeah, I mean, it's just terror tactics. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, and this is the thing that's it's distressing for me to see that European leaders are, you know, not stepping up, not providing the defences that are needed, the copious resources, particularly the likes of the Germans have, to contribute. But yes, each winter, when March starts, we saw them off for another winter. They tried to destroy our energy infrastructure. They tried to effectively freeze us out. And they failed. So that kind of, if you like, kind of wave of kind of defiance, resilience. Defiance is, I suppose, and I probably didn't mention it, something that you just experience in spades, you know. But yes.
They don't want Zelensky to give in, I imagine.
No, absolutely not. But then look, the Field of Mars, as it's called, in Lviv, where I've been a few times, was the new military graveyard. And 2 weeks ago, it was full and they've got to find another burial ground. So the resilience and defiance is there, but the cost of lives many cases, very young lives as well, it's absolutely palpable. Even somewhere like Lviv, that is obviously so. As I always say, any time that Lviv is targeted with drones or missiles, it's nearer Berlin than it is the front line. And yet, Europe, US, lets this happen.
Mm.
Sorry. That's topic of...
No, I mean, look, it's fascinating because you've had that lived experience of it, and to see the sort of EU capitulation largely toward there before Christmas when it came to Belgium's objections to actually using the money.
I mean, absolutely, you know what I mean? As a few of us had in a protest, no more waffle Belgium, you know, make Russia pay, but always... The EU, you know, and it is the flaw there. There's always the one little weak point somewhere, be it Orban actively frustrating.
Sometimes Ireland is the weak point.
Absolutely. Or be it, as I say, kind of, you know, somebody said, well, we don't want dual trade to be sanctioned. And in Belgium's case, the assets. There's always a weak point that stops the right thing being done.
Yeah.
You shouldn't leave Miriam's awards, though, without an honourable mention for Michael Lowry, the single most distinguished member of the Dáil.
Go on, which awards did he? He's picked up a few.
He more or less won all of them. I mean, he deserves an award for most awards. I think he won Gobshite of the Year, Chancellor of the Year. I'm mistaken. He won Dealmaker of the Year, Brass Neck Award, and Gesture of the Year for his famous two fingers to
Paul
the
Murphy.
Opposition. But he's coming up again and again and again. Next year, I think she should call them the Michael Lowry Masterclass Awards.
It's remarkable how quickly we moved off Michael Lowry in terms of the news agenda in the second half of the year, given he dominated the first half between the speaking rights row and everything else.
It is. But he'll be back. Michael Lowry never, ever goes away.
Valerie, did you have a favourite award of the year?
Well, I did. I rather liked the fashion awards. I mean, these were a little bit pathetic, actually, because Tánaiste Simon Harris's bucket hat won the fashion awards. He was sporting this at the Oasis concert, along with these very dark glasses that made him look a bit like a film star, if you like. So, you know, this is just something that I think is kind of scary, actually. The other one was Sinead Gibney of the Social Democrats, and this was a bit more serious. She gets the Palestinian flag painted on her nails, and some wags dubbed her Nelson Mandela for that.
Nelson Mandela, I think, was the exact pun.
Yes, Nelson Mandela. And then also the lovely Dickie Bow worn by her party colleague Owen Hayes at a Social Protection Committee meeting. So, I mean, there were lots of things like that. Then there was the women senators and the TDs from Sinn Féin, who all wore shorts in the Dáil and Shannon in solidarity with the women in the GAA over the skorts controversy. I thought that was a good one. That probably should have got the main prize there.
Yeah, I think Simon happened.
You shouldn't forget to mention, in the fashion category, the very large blue handbag.
of course. But that got Hermes. That got inanimate object of the year.
Okay.
The Hermes bag.
I don't think it was inanimate myself. I think it was speaking loudly.
You got about 3%.
Probably would have outpolled Jim Gavin, in fairness, by the end of things. That was Miriam Lord's Awards of the Year. And I happen to know, actually, it'd be interesting to see if Sinead Gibney gets anything from her team, because we gave her new TD of the Year Award when the Dáil term ended back in July or whatever it was that time, and I know that her team actually made her a sash, a Rose of Tralee style sash with that on board. So there you go. Maybe I don't think she'll be getting the same one for Nelson Mandela. Coming up after the break, my panel is staying with me, and we're going to be talking about the state papers, these declassified papers from 30 years ago, and what they tell us about the Ireland of 1995. And all across the papers today are these declassified state papers back from the middle of the 90s, back from 1995, and quite a few interesting tidbits in there, Louisa, especially particularly like the Mail's spin on this one. Shannon, we've got a problem, could have been the headline that bore us after the, was it the Artemis shuttle launch?
Yeah, so the shuttle launch from NASA in June 1995, they had to plan a number of different landing spots, and while Spain was their most likely position or place, Shannon, with its 3,199 metre runway, was to be included in the worldwide list of potential landing sites. And it would seem our Department of Foreign Affairs confirmed that the government would provide all possible assistance in the unlikely event of the shuttle needing to carry out an emergency landing here to safeguard the lives of the astronauts. What I'm most curious about, to be honest, is what sort of skills did we have in 1995 to deal with spaceships and astronauts that we do not have today?
Could you imagine, Barry, the infrastructure to deliver a space launch on Shannon?
Well, this would have been the Shannon stopover to end them all, I have to say. Whatever. I have to say, kind of knowing transport enthusiasts, be it rail enthusiasts in my own world or aviation enthusiasts, can you imagine the hype if the space shuttle had landed? I love the fact that like Zaragoza was the main site, but there was an 8 to 20 second period where if insufficient power was available, that is the window, in which Shannon would have come into play. It would have been the most extraordinary. And I have to say, I'm delighted that we worked with that. And maybe it's one of those things with the Americans ask, you don't really have an option to say no, whatever. But the guys could have gone into the duty free, and stocked up before heading on. I think it would have been the most amazing moment, as I say, in kind of Irish aviation history had it happened. And I am delighted that we stepped up to the plate and said, yep, we're here to help.
Shannon might not be called Shannon anymore, though, with our tendency to rename things after American presidents. We could have had a whole new name.
Trump International.
Oh, no.
Let's not go there. I just have this image of someone sitting there plane watching, and then suddenly comes the shuttle Artemis.
Valerie, we promised we would get through an entire hour without mentioning that word Trump.
47 minutes and 52 seconds. That's what we got. Fergus, we were saying, I feel like it's weird that we're looking at 30 years of this and it's only 1995 ago, but you remember a lot of these events.
They say you're getting old when the policemen start looking really young. In my case, when the cardinals and the Pope look young. I was in my 40s and I was working for the government in 1995. And there are bits of it I will never forget. The previous year, 94, well covered last year in the state papers, was probably the most turbulent political year in my lifetime, a political year of my political career, anyway. We had the Anglo-Irish, we had the ceasefire, we had the Irish ceasefire, and then we had the collapse of the government. Albert's government gone, John Bruton in, and in between all those things, we had a series of political events that are sort of burned into my soul. And then John Bruton took over in charge of the peace process. And from the moment the ceasefire happened until the following February 95, my boss, Dick Spring, was engaged almost entirely on his own, as it happens, from an Irish government point of view, in negotiations with Patrick Mayhew and John Major government around a document called the Joint Framework Documents, which were the seminal documents. They're not often mentioned in the same breath, but the Good Friday Agreement wouldn't have happened without the Joint Framework Documents. If you read it now, every element of the Good Friday Agreement, it's like the agenda and the solutions in shorthand. for the Good Friday Agreement, all done. And it was negotiated with that government month after month, it ended in 94, started in 95, with a government in London that had no majority. John Major was entirely dependent on the unionists, and it was the most difficult negotiation. There was a period in the middle of it, at the start of 95, not thankfully covered in the state papers yet anyway, when we went to London to accompany President Robinson on a visit to the Queen. And for 3 days, a number of Irish senior public servants were locked in the Dorchester Hotel, going backwards and forwards to Patrick Mayhew by day, briefing Dick Spring in the evening, and gazing longingly at the minibar, this enormous minibar in the suite in the Dorchester Hotel. Every morning we went out to Marks and Spencer's and bought a new shirt. We came back in and looked longingly at, terrified to open it, because of the bill that would be landed on the Irish government when we got home.
And revealed in the state papers.
Yes. And revealed in the state papers. And when we got home, it was to discover that the British government were footing the bill for the entire trip, the entire stay. If we'd known that, we'd have savaged the minibar. But four or five of us, we called ourselves the Dorchester Four in the end, or Dorchester Five, whatever it was, because of the suffering that we had to do for Ireland. But it was an amazing achievement, those papers. They're published, they're covered in the state papers because there was a big event in Hillsborough where John Major and John Bruton published them. But they were hugely controversial at the time, hugely difficult, and kind of an unforgettable period. And it really is kind of shocking to discover that you're now in the... I don't think I mentioned it all, actually, but to my shame, but that event is now in the state papers. Yeah. When I was reading the state papers when I was younger, De Valera was in the state papers and the Mass and foreign minister, British foreign ministers whose names I couldn't speak about and couldn't remember. And now it's us. Yeah. It's amazing. It's astonishing.
Amazing how time catches up on you.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting ones I thought in it actually regarding to Northern Ireland is the secret UN peacekeeping plan that was so secret they didn't even tell the UN about it.
They didn't. And thanks be to God, it was never... Now, that I think was first formulated in Jack Lynch's time. There was those kind of discussions went on throughout the Jack Lynch period and ever after that. There was always the possibility that Ireland would go to the UN and say, we need peacekeepers in here. And of course, that would have been absolutely anathema to any British government, and especially to the British government that poor old Gareth Fitzgerald had to deal with, which is led by Margaret Thatcher. But every government, every Irish government, contemplated the possibility that the UN might have to be called in. You remember the 80s and the late 80s and the early 90s, the carnage that was happening in Northern Ireland, the murders, the unspeakable crimes that were going on, loyalist murders, IRA murders particularly. I mean, it was just appalling, and there was no way of stopping it. And the things like the introduction of internment, the role of the British Army, which were originally welcomed onto the streets of Northern Ireland and then became the enemy. It seemed like there was no other way at various different times.
Valerie, we'll give the final state paper story to you, and there's quite a few in there. Christy Moore being arrested, Boys Own Hysteria, Gerry Adams and Bill Clinton, Diana and Charles. Where do you want to... What stood out to you?
Well, I think the handshake. The US didn't want a photo of Bill Clinton shaking hands with Gerry Adams. So they had all sorts of arrangements around their receptions and so on, changing the numbers, diluting Gerry Adams a bit and so on. And it was being hosted by the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Patrick Mayhew at the time. And Peter Bell from the Northern Ireland office said that America would prefer to avoid a handshake photo. But there's actually lots of light stuff in there as well. Just a couple of things I wanted to mention. In 1995, the then Britain's Prince Charles decided to come on a 2-day visit to Ireland. But of course, so much stuff has come out over the years now that we really get where Diana was as well, his ex-wife, that she, well, they were separated at the time, that, you know, she was trying to upstage him and upstage St. James's Palace at every turn. So she then sent a flyer out saying that she was actually thinking of a state visit to Ireland as well. And that really sent everybody running in every direction because, you know, diplomacy with Britain and so on. As it happens, she didn't come. So that was all right. But the other one that made the state papers, which I thought was amazing, was the Boyzone gig Now, this is very interesting because it was in 1995 and there were, during the gig, 12 people collapsed and had to be taken to hospital.
Were now, they all female?
I don't know. It didn't say that, actually, Fergus.
Well, it did say that they were gone for hysteria, so probably.
And they hadn't been drinking.
Oh.
That's, oh. As in if the I language.
That, if I had said that, Louise.
The language that's used, it's not used for men. It should be. But it's not.
Be.
Why is Fergus assuming it was women? I mean, I
didn't. I asked.
You asked. But it entered your head. So look, the boys.
I've never known a man to faint at a boys' own concert. Okay, let's be honest.
Have you been to many boys' own concerts?
No.
They were very young. They were sort of between 12 and 15, and they've been queuing.
And they hadn't been drinking. I think they mean water.
Yeah, they've been there since 9 in the morning.
But the Guardian, everybody discussed this, and a memo was sent to the minister. You know, what can we do about this? We should have things in place. I mean, today, if 12 people collapsed at a concert, you wouldn't bat an eyelid. You just step over them.
And around that time, I can't remember the exact year, but around that time, there were men and women fainting and being carried off from Ballinspittle. Remember
that's
that?
Right. Oh, the moving statue.
The moving statue.
Oh, the moving
statue.
Well,
that was 85.
Oh, right. Well, it did move for a few years
older
as well.
Older and older. Yeah.
That was great fun. Brought a whole new feeling to religion in Ireland. People gathered, brought their hip flasks. And their
you were there.
I was there as a 12-year-old, yes.
I
from Ballinspittle to Ukraine. It was there's flashing. A memoir in this.
I remember the only movement this statue is going to make is put an umbrella up. You know?
Well, we've heard an awful lot about you today, Barry Kenny, I have to admit.
From Ballinspittle to Gaeilge.
And we had a moving statue in Avoca as well.
Oh, right.
Just to let you know, Avoca, County Wicklow. Yeah.
Well, there you go. We'll have to get a history of that next time. I'm sorry we've run out of time because we've just hit on gold as we finished here. My thanks to Barry Kenny, Head of Corporate Communications at Éireann Ródaire, and Valerie Cox, author and journalist, Fergus Finlay, columnist with the Irish Examiner, former CEO of Bernardo's, and Louisa Meehan of Woodview HRM. Thanks so much for coming in and for chatting to us on this Betwixtmas Day, the 27th of December.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.